Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 247th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the greatest basketball players and most colorful characters of all time. A man who stands at 7'1", weighs well over 300 pounds, wears size 22 shoes and 60 XL suits, and over the course of 19 seasons in the NBA, simply dominated, scoring 28,596 points, number 7 all-time, landing 11,330 field goals, number 6 all-time, snagging 13,099 rebounds, number 15 all-time, and blocking 2,732 shots, number 8 all-time. He was the NBA's Rookie of the Year in 1993 and an Olympic gold medalist in 1996, a two-time league scoring champion, a 15-time All-Star, a four-time NBA champion, and a 2016 inductee into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, the great Shaquille O'Neal. Since announcing his retirement from basketball in 2011, Shaq has continued to excel in other areas. A savvy businessman, he earns tens of millions of dollars every year from product endorsements. An insightful analyst of the game of basketball, he has become a popular TV commentator on TNT's show Inside the NBA. And a restless artist with a social conscience who knows that he can make a big difference by championing little projects, he has become, of all things, a film producer. Of narrative films, like the 2017 faith-based drama Steps, and of documentaries, like the 2018 portrait of promising students in a gang-infested community, A Week in Watts. Most recently, he signed on as a producer of Ben Cummings and Orson Cummings' documentary feature Killer Bees, which powerfully captures a side of the Hamptons that few know about, in which a primarily black high school's basketball team, nicknamed the Killer Bees, fought to defend its 2015 state title while simultaneously confronting racism, gentrification, and income inequality. Could Shaq follow in the footsteps of his former Los Angeles Lakers teammate Kobe Bryant, who earlier this year won an Oscar? Only time will tell. Meanwhile, over the course of our conversation at WeWork in Century City, the 46-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics, including how the unusually large stepson of a military man first discovered the game of basketball and what appealed to him about it, how his own high school experience and college experience shaped him as a man and a center who would enter the NBA draft after his junior year at LSU, how, as a pro, he handled adversity, like struggling mightily to land free throws, made tough decisions like leaving the Orlando Magic for the Lakers in 1996, and asserted his views like wanting to play with Penny Hardaway in Orlando, Dwayne Wade in Miami, and LeBron James in Cleveland. How he kept himself stimulated off the court, resulting in a college degree, master's degree, and doctorate, and what he says the truth is behind his often reported tensions with Bryant, and how much Bryant's success with film has impacted his own interest in being part of the industry. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by Gabe Polsky, a filmmaker who has produced documentaries like His Way, which aired on HBO in 2009, and the Emmy-nominated National Geographic limited series Genius, and who has directed two fascinating sports-related docs, first 2014's Red Army, which looks at Russian-U.S. relations through the prism of hockey, and now In Search of Greatness, a film about what separates the greatest athletes from the rest, which the new distribution company AOS, as in Art of Sport, will release in select theaters on November 2nd and expand from there. Gabe, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Scott.
So how did the idea of becoming a filmmaker first enter the picture for you? I think it was not the usual circuit of events, right?
Yeah. So, you know, basically, you know, I grew up, I wanted to be a professional hockey player. And around my senior year in college at Yale, I sort of realized that, you know, it was not going to happen, basically. That's when I kind of started looking at what else, you know, I could really be passionate about, like I was for hockey, and sort of, you know, I was always kind of a class clown and, you know, by nature, you know, looking to entertain people and, you know, how could I sort of make that a profession without getting in trouble, right? You know, it was the kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of my friends and colleagues at Yale were sort of all, it seemed like they're all flooding to Wall Street, mm-hmm. or kind of going to law school or, you know, whatever, doing something like that. And but my roommate at Yale was basically doing a lot of sketch comedy and editing videos all the time. And he was a really kind of funny guy. He's in Hollywood now. Yeah. And basically that kind of sparked an interest. I didn't know anything about films or I mean, aside from kind of the generalities, yeah. But, you know, I started basically reading everything I could about, you know, about films and obviously watching a lot and thinking, you know, how do I fit in to this industry? Is this something I could be passionate about for a long time? Is this what I want to do? And so basically that was the spark, and, you know, I pursued it and kind of was voracious like I was, you know, with hockey. But, you know, again, the question is sort of where do I channel that creative energy that I had for hockey in another direction?
And and so I guess for the first few years you were in a partnership with your brother, right? And it was initially producing, not directing. Can you explain how producing gave way to directing?
You know, initially I thought, you know, producing would be an interesting thing that I could do because I you know, I like kind of putting things together and sort of having an idea and then kind of taking steps to put the whole thing together, from kind of the creative aspect to financing to, you know, cast and all that. But, and that was great. And, you know, it was a really interesting learning curve. One of the first things that we kind of got our hands on and we wanted to start big was the Albert Einstein estate. So basically we were able to meet with the Hebrew University and the estate and basically convince them, we were two young guys, I think I was like 26.
Yeah.
Convince them, you know, that we could do something special with that. And I guess no one had done that before. And at the time, Walter Isaacson biography was coming out, and we were able to talk Walter into giving us the rights to that. And that's how that all started.
So basically there was nobody owned the screen rights to Einstein's life?
Exactly. So, you know, the rights to his estate is like certain personality and likeness rights. Mm-hmm. So no one had, surprisingly, no one was sort of, you know, they hadn't, either the timing was off or whatever.
But. Yeah. And that's one of the things, I guess, you know, certainly key to what a producer does, just finding stories that and rights that are available and locking it up. So that was the beginning of what led to Genius, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the long time had passed after it sort of became a TV show.
Right.
It started out, we were developing it as a feature film at Lionsgate, and kind of eventually it changed many forms and shapes, and it ultimately became part of this series at Nat Geo.
What's kind of interesting, though, is that from that through your most recent work, In Search of Greatness, it seems like there's something about the mind that has intrigued you, and probably going back to hockey as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been intrigued by, like, people that, you know, are doing things differently, thinking outside of the box, and, you know, using their creative abilities and their imagination to kind of change the game, their field, whether it be sports, like your Wayne Gretzky, like In Search of Greatness, or in science, Albert Einstein, a guy who was often sort of chastised and alienated from the scientific community because he was thinking differently. No one liked him. He was sequestered to, you know, a patent office, because no one wanted to deal with him and or give him acceptance to university. And it was only because of those sort of, let's say, failures or rejection that he was able to spend the time to really develop his thoughts, experiment and play in his mind and use his imagination to kind of reinvent science. And you see very similar trends even in sports, in any field, like from Steve Jobs, but basically people who don't fit the mold.
Well, so which, I want to ask you about a couple others that you've dealt with in your film. So His Way, which I mentioned earlier, is about a guy who recently passed away but was a big presence in this town for a while, Jerry Weintraub. He wasn't exactly the conventional producer, right?
No, he was very unique, and I don't think really anyone that I've seen like is out there today that's like him. He was a, you know, there's a lot of people that are a force of nature, you know, like the Scott Rudins and so on. But Jerry, I don't know. He was different. He could get things done. He, you know, people think, oh, well, he's just powerful. Well, how did he get powerful? Mm-hmm. It's incredibly creative to rise to that level. That doesn't just happen out of thin air. The guy worked so hard, and he had to be really flexible and improvisational in the way he dealt with people and the way he saw opportunity and created it. And sort of, you know, when he saw an obstacle, he was able to basically transform it into an opportunity.
And he had his own eccentricities too, like Einstein. I mean, here's a guy, what was he, living with his ex-wife while living with a wife and a girlfriend, or what was the whole?
Yeah, I mean, basically that's what it was.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, and Einstein also sort of had a strange personal, you know, sex life or whatever. But, you know, that's...
There's no
that's
one rule that applies to everybody.
But, yeah, that's not...
But you ended up getting into narrative films, I know, as one of the producers of the 2011 indie Little Birds, and then directing, I think for the first time with your brother, a narrative film in 2012, The Motel Life. But the film that, for me, and I think a lot of people first registered really in a big way was a movie that came out in 2014 called Red Army. It premiered at Cannes and also screened at the Telluride, Toronto, New York, and AFI Film Festival, something that was true of no other documentary that year. Won the Audience Award at AFI Chicago and Middleburg Fests, and gets into subject matter that I think made you the perfect person to direct it because of the fact that, as I think you mentioned earlier, and if not, we'll mention it again, son of Soviet immigrants, hockey-obsessed kid, who now is looking for sort of psychological behavior that's interesting and unusual, clearly, through the other films. So here, can you just explain when along the line you first realized that there might be a film to be made about the Soviet national ice hockey team during the years leading up to the fall of the Soviet Union?
I guess it all started from, you know, when I was a kid, I got my hands on some videotapes of basically the Soviet Union playing hockey, let's say in the 80s. And, you know, when I was a kid, I just couldn't believe what I'd seen. It was like seeing creativity in its pure form and sport in a way I've never seen. What they were doing with the puck, how beautiful and creative and sort of improvisational their style of play was. Like nothing that was being played in North America. It was like a ballet, like hard to even, you know, kind of describe. But and so that kind of catalyzed an interest. And then ultimately, I started doing a little bit of research about this team and, you know, what was happening at the time. And the more research I did, the more I realized that really the path of this team and what they were going through kind of mirrored the path of what the country was going through. Also, we were able to see kind of who these people really were and sort of what they were dealing with and the politics, the economic situation, like basically everything in human nature. And really, I just thought that it could be an epic story. And then I happened upon, you know, the main character in the film, who was the captain of the Soviet Union team, Slava Fetisov, who's just kind of like a really interesting, mm-hmm. kind of strange character that I was able to kind of anchor the film around, and I started, basically, I went from there.
It's great. And I think some of the best books or movies that I've come across, I feel like are about something that we all assume we already know everything about, or many of us think we do. So in this case, you know, everybody who has even a passing interest in sports knows about the Do You Believe in Miracles game in 1980 Lake Placid, where the Americans beat the Soviets, huge upset. Americans go on to the gold medal that everyone thought the Soviets were going to win, but that there would be this whole backstory and also the implications of it running all the way through the present of U.S.-Russian relations was so eye-opening for people, and I think that was kind of incredible. But I want to ask you about somebody who was listed on that movie as an executive producer and who you produced a 2009 film for, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, and that is Werner Herzog. How did you two first cross paths, and how has he influenced you as a filmmaker? Because he's another guy who probably you could put in the mold of an Einstein or a Weintraub, or just not like anybody else.
He beats by his own drum, and he's one of the very unique voices in film history. So basically, we were developing this project, Bad Lieutenant, in 2008, and basically it was a re-envisioning of the old Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel, which was also a great piece. We wanted to do something that was like, not a remake, but kind of like James Bond, you know, just another one.
Yeah,
it was a weird ideal, but we developed a script, and truthfully, the script was kind of, I guess, fairly run-of-the-mill, right? So we didn't know what to do. And so about a year before, I'd seen this movie Grizzly Man.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, okay, this guy's weird, he's interesting. I really, it's like, fell in love with Werner Herzog, started watching a lot of his stuff, and I was just like, listen, this movie's not going to work with basically anyone but just a total strange, interesting filmmaker. And so, you know, at the time, Werner had never really, like, takes other people's scripts and, you know, directs them. But I don't know, I had maybe a naive idea that maybe we could get him to direct it. And, you know, maybe because, you know, we're young or something. So anyways, I talked to Ed Pressman, mm-hmm. who sort of a legendary producer, and he got the script to Werner, and somehow Werner said yes. And at that point, he got Nick Cage to do it right away, and we were on set within like 2 months. We got the movie financed, and it was in New Orleans in the middle of summer, kind of crazy. And so basically Werner, that's how we developed a relationship with him. And it's not a thing where it's like, I sit down with him every week, and you know, a lot of people in this town, they love talking about their mentors, right. You know, but Werner, he's not like a guy you call every right. week and say how you doing, you know, right. but when, you know, every so often we get together. And what's interesting about him is his sort of viewpoint is so different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's like, no matter what he says, it always sticks with you, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, just the way he looks at the world is different. And I just feel like, yeah, he's just always kind of a force. Whenever I sort of get in a bind, I sort of think, what would Werner do yeah. in this situation? You know, he's incredibly tough and resilient, has dealt with tremendous rejection in his career and never compromises his vision. If you look at the great, you know, filmmakers, they all have that. They don't compromise mm-hmm. their creative vision. And that's why we like their work.
Well, and I think the interesting thing also about Werner and one of his close friends, at one time frenemies, but now I think they're outright friends, Errol Morris, is they in their documentaries have had an incredible way of getting people to open up about things that you wouldn't think they would talk about. And that is something that lives on in the films of Gabe Polsky, because in Red Army, I know it was not easy to even get somebody like Fetisov to sit down with you, let alone to get him to open up about stuff that happened years ago and has changed the course of his life and other people's as well. So what's been your technique, starting with Red Army, and then you can continue through In Search of Greatness, where you get these most elite athletes in the world to sit down and give an actually revealing interview?
It's a great question, but the truth is that I think the more you be yourself as an interviewer, the more you can get, and the more the voice, the more the subject kind of understands you and you can connect. You're not trying to be like kind of quote unquote the interviewer, you know? And I think I'm a sort of a weird guy. Like I don't sort of ask the typical questions and behave typically for some reason. And first of all, I'm not like Charlie Rose where I can interview people every day nonstop. It's like, it's kind of rare when I actually get enough money to make a movie and it can interview. So I'm not like a practice interviewer. So I'm just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, I know I've got Wayne Gretzky or Jerry Rice or Pelé for literally an hour. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's survival. What am I going to do? I need to get something engaging and interesting. It's something that fits the story. You know, obviously I have questions, but it's like looking for the surprises, looking for the humanity, trying, you know, being present, being so mm-hmm. in there and surviving, mm-hmm. trying to survive as a filmmaker. You know what I'm saying? There's no rules. You right. can't try and be like Werner, or like right. this guy, or ask like this, or now I'm going to do this.
But are there sometimes technical even things that you can do? I think with Errol, his famous thing, you know, he's got his Interatron. So that's what he calls his camera, where the yeah. subject feels like they're talking right to him. So you end up having the camera essentially look right into these people's mm-hmm. soul. He'll sometimes, I know, ask a question, get an answer, and then not say anything for another awkward, you know, yeah. 10 seconds or something, because sometimes people are so uncomfortable with the silence that they'll then right. say something revealing. Have any of those kinds of techniques over the course of, you know, his way into Red Army, into In Search of Greatness, you know, have you seen that some things like that are more effective than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit more natural to let the camera go a little bit. And, you know, it depends too on how long you have these mm-hmm. guys. If you have a really short interview, you can't like set up an Interatron and da-da-da-da. And, you know, it all depends on like who it is you're mm-hmm. doing, how much time you have. And like, you got to think about what the style of the film is too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not like with certain high profile guys, you have so much time to light it and set it up and have 15 hours to shoot it. I mean, so it depends on that. But, you know, I think filmmakers are just trying to keep it dynamic and yeah. engaging. How do you do that? Like sometimes you can move the camera. Like how much can you do with the, obviously if you're shooting a Verite film, there's much more movement mm-hmm. and you know, you can get stuff, but you could have thousands of hours of footage. But what if you have like only an hour with them? Right. Like what do you do to keep it dynamic? And sometimes you could use zoom lenses. You could use, it's just like literally all you have is a box.
Yeah.
And you got to figure out how to
make it a little exciting. Yeah. Well, the way you framed the interviews in Search of Greatness was something that jumped out to me from the first time I saw it. And I want to ask you how you decided to do that? And also, for somebody who hasn't yet seen it, maybe you can describe what you were doing and then why you did it.
Basically, the whole idea is you try and like capture the soul of who you're talking to, really who they are. It's not what people say in an interview. It's like, it's all about the pauses and how they're behaving when you do certain things. And so you're trying to catch those moments. So I think, you know, it's important to communicate with your DP to really like be in tune to the person and react to them almost as they're reacting, which means maybe moving the camera, maybe using Zoom, maybe, you know, handheld a little bit without distracting the audience too much. But you want it to kind of feel natural and not just like static, you know? So I think part of it's like a little bit of experimentation. Sometimes, you know, you can't experiment too much because you don't have time to screw up. If you screw up during a critical moment, you don't have that to use in your editing. So,
Well, with Red Army, I want to ask you about the rollout and the way it all panned out with that movie, because you end up with Sony Classics distributing you guys and getting all kinds of acclaim as far as reviews and buzz for awards. And then in one of the most bizarre things that I've seen in all the years of covering award season, the Academy documentary branch neglected to shortlist, let alone nominate. To me, this was a movie that could have and maybe should have won. But I've read other things where you've talked about that and said that going through that, which I'm sure wasn't fun in the moment, maybe did have some residual benefit because it put things in perspective. Is that fair to say?
I think Sony Classics was like incredibly confident with that film, and based on the reviews and the energy and all the festivals and all that. And so I was just kind of like going with the flow and okay, you know, well, I guess this is really possible and whatever. And you kind of, you know, you support the hell out of it, even whether it was up for it or not. But there's so many dynamics in this Oscar type of thing. And sometimes like the luck is there. And sometimes I guess, you know, there's other dynamics that I just don't know how to control. And I'm not, I don't know. I mean, you could sit there all day and say, oh, well, they don't want me. They don't like me. You know, these people, the committee or whatever. And so, well, whatever. And that's fine. I mean, the only thing, I mean, anyone could admit as a fact that if you are nominated, if you win, that it helps your career.
Sure.
And anyone in this business, all they care about really is making that next movie. We're passionate people. We want to get movies made. So that's why that matters. Right. We just want to keep getting movies financed.
And I think it just kind of puts it in the perspective of it's in a lot of ways a crapshoot. And you know, I always come back to the example of Steve James, who a lot of people think is as great a documentary filmmaker as there is, wasn't nominated for Hoop Dreams, which, again, is, I think, the IDA's greatest documentary ever, wasn't nominated for Life Itself, which was another one that people thought would potentially win, and then gets nominated for a movie that nobody thought would nominated.
That's classic. Yeah. I mean, it's literally like, it's almost like that happens more often than not, that kind of thing. But the same happens in sports. I mean, we're talking about this, like, guys get passed over like Tom Brady and many people like that because they don't sort of fit the mold or whatever it is. They're not picked. Mm-hmm. And then they end up being, you know, Tom Brady. Yeah. So it's interesting. But I think even what's more interesting with Red Army is that it became, you know, tremendously successful with all the festivals and so on. But literally a month before Cannes, I got a pass by literally every single studio. Every single distributor for Red Army. There was literally zero options.
For distribution.
Okay, I was literally, that was it. The film was going to be basically, who knows, VOD, I don't know, in a dustbin somewhere, right?
Right.
I'd put my own money into it. And I just happened to like look at the list that CAA gave me. And, you know, there was basically, you know, I didn't see Sony Classics on there or there was no response or whatever. And so I just basically said, all right, screw this. I'll call them myself. Mm-hmm. And I called Tom Bernard, and the rest is history. But
and
can
it
you imagine
that he's a big hockey fan?
Yeah. But the idea is that same thing with In Search of Greatness. It's like you could be so close to failure, like literally inches. Mm-hmm. The same movie that became one of the bigger docs of the year was inches from failure. If I hadn't picked up the phone, if I just said, "Oh, okay, well, I guess you know,"
that's that.
I guess that's it. Like,
yeah, that's incredible.
But that's life. You know, it's those inches that sort of, whether a movie can be huge or just nothing.
Right. So that brings us to In Search of Greatness. I want to focus on that specifically and ask you why you recently called it, quote, my most personal film, close quote. I guess, why did you decide to do it and what makes it so personal?
You know, I guess I grew up always sort of as a hockey player, and, you know, as a kid, I always sort of questioned authority a little bit and was wondering why, as a hockey player, why we were forced to do certain drills, you know, why certain athletes were picked and others weren't. And, you know, basically why coaches were coaching a certain way. Right. And when you do that, you risk a little bit too, because, you know, a lot of times no one likes to be questioned, I think, and especially coaches and sometimes teachers as well. And oftentimes you find yourself, you know, on the bench or, you know, and so basically when I was a kid, I loved to go to the stadium and watch incredibly creative athletes, guys that were doing stuff that you've never seen before, magical performance, entertainers that were just like Muhammad Ali, like, even though I was too young, but yeah, just poets, artists, right, on the court. And I found that, you know, that's what I wanted to see. I'd spend any amount of money, I'd wait forever just to see that one moment of greatness, you know, greatness equaling creativity. But then when you go back to practice and you try and do these creative things, you're told to basically conform. Don't do that. You know, so creativity and self-expression was not encouraged as a kid. It was, in fact, you're taught to conform. So I always sort of wondered, why is that? You know, that those guys are the exception, and, mm-hmm, and no one should really do that. So, and I found that as the higher I got level wise in hockey, the worse it got. Mm-hmm. And it really bothered me, this idea that I always believed that creativity, self-expression, and freedom were the bedrock for greatness. Mm-hmm. Yet nobody in the sports world ever talks about that, mm-hmm, or believes that, almost as if they don't even understand what greatness is. Mm-hmm. Literally, because it is, that's what it is.
Well, yeah. Is there a crisp definition of greatness?
Well, it's different, let's say, in entertainment and sports, which I feel are fairly synonymous, but this idea of somebody doing something extraordinary, but what that means is they're doing something that almost we've never seen before. It's creativity, it's artistry, basically, mastering your craft. And those creative performances often are inspired by imagination. It's basically seeing, like, look in filmmaking, okay? You know, guys like, even when Spielberg started and you know, all these guys, Scorsese, PTA, I mean, the reason why we liked them, Tarantino, is because they were doing something we've never seen. Right. We're like, wow, like, I just saw something that I've never seen, and it's so powerful, and it really affected me. And the same can be said in any field.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting to tie this movie to Red Army, that what was interesting to you about the Soviet team was how creative and expressive they were on the ice, whereas the Americans were kind of conventional, yeah, conformists. Yeah. And yet when those players stepped off the ice, it was the exact opposite for both of them.
Yeah, exactly. You pretty much nailed that. I don't know. I think one reason why, I think, is that the Soviets, because they were so oppressed in their lives and they were staying in the base alone, and it was that once they got on the ice, that was when they could express, mm-hmm, their creativity. They were at least allowed to play, and, you know.
So what does that tell us about greatness in general? Is it that
maybe in Americans are too sort of free on the outside? I could play this, I could do this, I could do that. And then once they kind of have to actually play, there's, mm-hmm, nothing left. There's no,
I mean, how about, let's put it this way, you and your wife, Justine, who we're going to give a shout out to. I love Justine. You guys just had a baby. If your aim with this child was to do everything you could to propel that child to greatness in whatever endeavor he pursues, what would be the best and worst things that you could do to make that happen? Is it a good thing to be a helicopter parent or a tiger mom or dad or whatever they call it these days? Or is it actually better to let the kid just explore and find their way, which seems to be the way that, you know, it seems like we're on either extreme in this country right,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like in my movie, you know, you look at the greatest athletes, they were never forced to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, greatness cannot be manufactured. You can't push someone to be great. No, it's inside of you.
Andre Agassi?
Well, he wasn't the greatest of all time, and right. I bet you that part of his greatness and creativity was that he was rebelling, mm-hmm, on the court. and I bet you saw that because Agassi was he was a unique guy mm-hmm. on the court totally. With his hair, with his style, and that was like, wow, okay, that guy's doing something different. He was angry because, yeah, he felt like he was forced, but it was coming out. The yep. creativity was coming out because of that, too. Mm-hmm. So I think we can look at him a little differently there. But as far as, you know, my kid is that I just think there's no question that the happier you are, the more you're doing what you love, whatever it is, you know. I think the better we are at what we do, 100,000%. I mean, it's like, but is it yeah, though? We all know that.
Don't you need a fire under your ass to drive you?
Yeah, but that comes from within.
So that may be the key, is that so you either have that or you don't. If you can't be a self-starter.
But I think that you can, if you find something that you really love, mm-hmm. then you don't need to be pushed to do anything. You show up, you wake up in the morning and that's what you want to do. You know, because you're driven. You want to express that, whatever that is.
We're all finding out.
Yeah, we'll
out.
See what happens.
Well, Gabe Polsky, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
And now for my interview with Shaquille O'Neal. Shaq, thank you so much for doing this.
No problem.
So we always begin with just a few basics because we kind of go through the life as much as we can in the time we have. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Born and raised in Newark, New Jersey. My father was a drill sergeant for the Army. And my mother was a housewife at first, and then she became a secretary when I got big because they needed extra money to feed me and my siblings.
Yeah, and you were one of how many?
I was one of five.
One of five. Why were you given the name Shaquille Rashawn O'Neal? What does it mean?
Because my mother tells a story in her book, Walk Like You Have Somewhere to Go. My mother comes from a very Christian family, so when I was born out of wedlock, we were outed, and I was her little warrior, and she realized that I was going to be different, so she wanted to give me a different name. So she didn't want to give me a John or Steve or David. Yeah. So she's walking down Newark, and a Muslim brother gives her a book of names, and she opens the page, and she sees little warrior, and I was the baby that never cried and never gave a problem, and she said, you know what? You're going to be my little warrior, so I'm going to name you Shaquille Rashawn.
That's great. Your family moved around a lot as a kid, which was interesting because it's something, I guess, that you and Kobe shared in common. Just like, can you explain why that was and how you think that shaped you as a kid?
It shaped me because it helps me deal with all. Now, when I say all, Spanish, European, African-American, white, mm-hmm. Cajun, Hispanic. Mm-hmm. So I always tell people I live sort of a karate kid life.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way my parents raised me, it's just they help cultivate the character the world knows as Shaq. I can relate to anybody, anywhere, anytime.
I can tell. Over many years, that's definitely been the case. And I guess one of the places where you guys went because of your dad's job, but I think where you weren't thrilled to be, was West Germany. How, while you were there, did basketball first enter the picture, I think?
Well, everything that's happened in my life has always been a blessing in disguise. Just when you're young and you're a juvenile delinquent, you don't know these things. It takes time. So as you're developing yourself into becoming a man, I had to figure things out. I didn't want to leave Newark, New Jersey. Relatives were there, cousins were there, grandparents were there. We had a system. Work, Friday go see grandma, Saturday go see the other grandma, Sunday hang out, play ball, fight with the cousins, the system. So now that the system was broken, I'm going to Germany. What's Germany? Never heard of it in my life. So now instead of driving myself crazy, I'm going to go to the gym. Uh-huh. Who's it? Dr. J? I want to be like him. So I start to build the character known as Shaq. So even though I was pissed off, it enabled me to focus on what I wanted to become. Because at age 13, I tell my son this all the time, you need to start thinking what you want to do. Because mm-hmm. in 5 years, you're going to be 18. Then mm-hmm. you're going to be a man. You're going to have to get out of my house. So you need to start thinking at 13, what do you want to do? And I only had two options, NBA and military.
Mm-hmm. And you were not interested in going to the military.
Right.
So the kind of fateful thing that happened, though, was who saw you there who would then come back into your life years later?
Dale Brown. He saw me at a camp. And I asked him if he'd send me a program to get stronger and make the sophomore team. His program didn't work. I got cut anyway because I was terrible.
When you went to high school, you mean?
Yes. I got cut my freshman year. Met Dale Brown after my freshman year. He sent me a program. I did everything he told me to do on a piece of paper. Still wasn't good enough. Got cut my sophomore year. So I write him a letter. Thanks, but Everybody says I'm terrible anyway. I suck. I'm 6'9", and I can't even make the high school team. I'm going to just join the Army. I already had a set that, hey, I got 720 days left living with my parents. I'll be 18. I'm going to the military. Mm-hmm. And I could already handle it because my father got me doing that stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. So I was already primed to go. And he said, no, I don't want you to do that. I'm going to give you a scholarship anyway. So when I got back and became one of the top high school players, everybody was coming at me. I was like, nope. When I was sorry and terrible, you didn't even look at me. So this guy's only got to look at me. So, you know, when you're in the military, it's all about loyalty.
Right.
He was loyal to me before I was Shaq. So now that I am Shaq, I have to remain loyal to him.
Because by the time it was time for you to look at colleges, there was no lack of interest at that point, right? So, but you.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody wanted me.
So that's how you went to LSU. But before you did, when your stepdad was transferred back to the U.S., to Texas, that's where you started, you know, junior and senior year of high school, right?
Yep.
And in those 2 years, I want to ask you about them because obviously Killer Bees is about the high school experience. And when we previously spoke, you said that in some ways your high school experience was very much like what these guys had, but also in other ways very different. Can you explain why?
Well, the similarities were we were dominant. The other similarities were we were well known. Mm-hmm. Once I got there, before I got there, yeah. They never had a winning season ever.
Mm-hmm.
They were small school, military bases, you know. So when I came there and we started winning, everybody started noticing us. I'm the type that when you tell me I can't do something, that's when I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they got this new kid named Shaq. He's pretty good. They're 12-0, but they'll never win state. Like, you know, Shaq is okay. All he does is dunk. He, you know, once he plays the bigger schools, he'll never play like this. So, you know, I got my group of guys together, and again, when you're in high school, I'm turning into a man. So now I'm, you know, studying how to be the leader, how to get these guys to follow me, and then it's good to have nothing and turn it into something.
Uh-huh.
Like if I could be the guy to just come here and make this school and win the school, that's forever,
uh-huh.
Right? But I want to do it in a way that's always forever. I want to go undefeated. So the first year, 35-1, we lost. I missed some free throws. It was my fault. But next year, we went 36-0. And now when I go back, jersey's there. I got a statue there. So this is the stuff that I was thinking at 18, 19 years old. Because people all my life have been telling me I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I said, you know what? Forget that.
Yeah,
I'm going to prove you wrong.
I want to ask you, though, about you said in those two seasons combined 68-1 record, the one loss, you're
saying
it was
all my fault.
You're saying it's your fault, but also.
No, it's my fault.
There was also some BS that you had to deal with, right?
Yeah, I got three fouls in the first 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. But what about hearing things?
Well, yeah, I grew up hearing stuff.
But like racist stuff?
Yeah, all the time. And, you know, when you grow up with a military father, you have to have that strong mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Like my father always tell me, people are going to say what they want to say. That's life. Mm-hmm. Don't let it affect you. They put your hands on you, whoop their ass. But they're trying to get you out of your element.
Right.
And the quicker they get you out of your element, the lesser you become. Like, I went to college at LSU.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think I heard stuff in Mississippi State? In Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But guess what? My element is to get drafted and to buy my mama a house. I'm not going to run up in the stands and start whooping ass.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that before. Like, you can't call me or say anything I've never heard before. I know who I am and I know what I do. Now, as soon as you touch me, now you're going to have some problems. But listen, like, I try not to lower my standards when it comes to dealing with ignorant people.
Right.
Like, I know all the, listen, I'm from New Jersey. I heard it there. I went to Germany. I heard some shit I ain't never heard.
Mm-hmm.
Moved back to Texas and then Baton Rouge. So, listen, it ain't nothing you can call me I ain't never heard.
Right.
And then living with a drill sergeant father.
Right.
It ain't nothing you could do to get me out of my element.
Right. Was there ever any question in high school or college that you would be a center?
Yes. I wanted to be a guard.
How come?
Because being a center is boring. I don't like being boring.
Can you tell if there's a listener who doesn't know basketball? Can you explain what the role of the center is?
The center is a guy that gets rebounds, blocks shots, plays defense. And if you're not a good center, that's the only thing you do. Now, if you have skills where you can shoot and you can dribble, they'll let you do extra. But most of the NBA centers, all they do is block shots, set screens, shoot, and they get what's called chippies.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be the go-to guy. I wanted to be the guy that, hey, we got to get him the ball first.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's all about hard work. In the movies, you know, these guys definitely work hard. They have a lot going on. Like, One of the players don't know if his mom could pay the rent. And, you know, a lot of kids don't know if their school's going to be there next year. So, you know, they're also dealing with certain issues.
Absolutely. So when you were headed off to college at LSU, you were pursuing a degree in business, but you ended up leaving after your junior year to enter the draft. And I guess the question I have is, was it only the appeal of the NBA that made you enter the draft? Or what? I had heard that there was also some frustration about the fact that the way the college rules were, certainly at that time, it was ridiculous the way that people could play against you, right?
It was a little bit of both. And it got to the point to where they were trying to stop me by using physicalness, which I didn't mind. But, you know, if you're in the air and you get taken down, I come down and blow my knee out and can never play again. Right. Lloyd's in London is only $1 million. Now, after FICA and all that, I'm only going to have $400,000, $500,000. But if you're the first pick or the second pick, you can get millions right away. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know what? It's time to get my mother house. Mm-hmm. I'm not dealing with these guys. I want to go play against the best and see what I could do here. So, you know, that was my whole dream as a kid, to just be able to say thank you. Mm-hmm. They sacrificed a lot. Like, yeah. I say, my mom and dad both worked two jobs. And if I can get a place where I can go and they own the deed to the house, that's the only thing I wanted to do. So I decided to go pro. Dick Vitale said that I would be the number one pick. So it was like, he's saying this now. You got to jump on it now.
You were, of course, number one for the Orlando Magic. Were you nervous or confident to be headed to the NBA? And also,
I was confident.
You were sure that you could?
Yeah, because my life is programmed to be a certain way and do certain things. Like, my thought process, because I was always on punishment, which is a great thing now that I think about it, it enabled me to be my own thinking man. So while I'm on punishment, I'm watching Chinese movies, karate movies, and I'm looking at them, and they're all the same. And the basis I got from the karate movie is, this young guy, in order to be the man, he has to take out the master. So when I come in, it's a lot of masters in front of me, but I want the spot now. Mm-hmm. Patrick Ewing, I want your spot. David Robinson, I want your spot. There's a lot of guys that's coming in with me, I want their spot too. Mm-hmm. So it was fun. It's a challenge for me. Like, I'm not going to be intimidated by another man. I want your spot. Like, when I first came out here to L.A., 92, after I got drafted, I'm looking at Magic Johnson. People are treating him like God. He's walking through, and everybody's clapping, and, you know, everybody's jumping on him. I was like, that's what I want right there. Yeah. That's what I want, and that's what I'm going to get. And nobody's going to stop me.
So How about on just a personal, off-the-court level? I understood that for the first year, probably at her insistence, your mother traveled around with you. And
no, that's not true.
She didn't go on the road with
you? No, they never traveled with me. My father's rule is, when you're 18, get out.
Okay, but so, not of the NBA.
No, yeah, get out. So, you know, I got the basis from them.
Yeah,
which is, be a leader, not a follower. And, you know, they always used to preach, you know, all these athletes go broke. Don't let that be you.
I read some interview that you did early on where you were saying that if some other athletes screwed up, you would get punished
all the time.
Why would they do that? Just so that got so seared into your mind that.
When Len Bias died, that was one of my worst ass whoopings ever. Like, my father came in the house with tears in his eye. Like, Len Bias was my brother. And he started grabbing me. He's like, if you ever do cocaine, I'll kill you. And I'm like, I don't even know what cocaine is.
Uh-huh.
I was like 12. Yeah. This happened in Germany. I was like 12, 13. He was crying the whole night. This man, he threw his life away because, you know, Len Bias had been the first pick.
Uh-huh.
It was like he was just tears, and then it just kept on me. If they ever do that, I'll kill you, right? So that's why, with him teaching me how to be a leader, I never did none of that stuff.
You don't drink?
No, I don't drink at all.
Yeah.
And I don't smoke weed. I don't do none of that because I know it can get you in trouble.
Yeah.
I ain't trying to get in trouble, especially not now with six kids. Like, I have to. You know, when I was in playing, I could have wiggle room to do whatever. But now that you're a daddy, you gotta set the straight.
Yeah,
so I don't do any of that.
So you were a star pretty much right out of the gate, rookie of the year. In your rookie year, you doubled the existing record for dunks in a season. Then 2 years later, you set a new record. But, you know, you were breaking backboards, all this stuff that was new. The one thing that people trying to stop you, I think they figured that maybe if we foul him instead of letting him dunk on us, we have at least a shot of not giving up 2 points. And for a while, I think they called it the Hack-a-Shack, right? That worked for a little while because free throws were sort of an Achilles heel. Did that bother you? You're so good at every other aspect of the game.
It's the man's way upstairs of keeping me humble.
Yeah.
And I know it's a rough part of my game. However, when you need a bucket down by one, I can easily turn it on.
Yeah.
But imagine me with all the success I have in shooting 90% for free throw line. I'd probably be one of these obnoxious rich people that'd be hard to deal with. So I have no flaws, yeah. Right?
Right.
Think about it. I'd be down there perfect.
Right.
Right? So right. It makes me imperfect, makes me human.
Absolutely.
So, but again, like during finals times.
You turned it on.
Always stepped up.
Yeah. You are, I think the Orlando years for you are always really closely associated with you and Penny Hardaway. And I read that in 93 when they acquired him, you were actually really the one responsible for that. How did you kind of put that in the mind of the team? Management.
Because again, when you're anointed the leader, especially with a new situation, you gotta figure it out on your own. So I've always been a respectable guy. So I'm coming out here one day and I'm watching Magic, and Magic is demanding stuff. Tell him I need this, tell him I need that. And I was like, okay, I'm not Magic, but in Orlando, I'm like Magic. Let me try it. So I went upstairs and be like, if you don't give me Penny Hardaway, I want out. And then I was like, whew. And then when I left, I was like, oh, hope I don't get in trouble for that.
Because
like,
you were only a year into being with the team.
Yeah, I was only a year in the league, but like I seen Magic and them boys do it. I was like, shit, I'm Magic in Orlando. So right. I went back, you know, threw him my jet, like, hey, man, I'm trying to win. I'm trying to be a champion. I need this kid, Penny Hardaway.
And you knew him from where?
I met him at Blue Chips.
Right.
And then I just tried. I was like, hey, if he not here, if y'all don't draft him, when my finger's up, I'm going to be looking to do other things.
They got on it pretty quickly.
And like all the guys, the big time guys, the Magic, even the owner was like, yeah, we'll work on it. And right. I left. I was like, damn, it works.
In the next season, 94-95, you won scoring title. You're the runner-up for league MVP. You guys got all the way to the finals. But then having gotten that close to the glory, you got swept by the Rockets. What does that teach a guy who's still young and kind of figuring his way in the league?
When you lose, it's always a learning experience. And there was only one lesson from that. The lesson is don't celebrate too early. Mm-hmm. And as I go back, we never talked about winning a championship. Let's just make the finals. Let's just make the finals. So after we made the finals, after we beat Mike, I'm the last guy to beat Mike. So mm-hmm. in my mind, shit, Mike's out. I'm good, right? We celebrate. We hanging out. We partying because we already beat Houston twice.
Right.
Hakeem is an okay player. Like, he got some stuff. I got some stuff. But I should be able to handle it. That's the finals, right? And then they had a different process, and they just took it to us. That's why after that, I always used to tell people, I'm not celebrating nothing until we win.
Yeah.
If you go back to all the footage and we win all the Eastern Conference, you never see me up front holding that little fake trophy, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. But that's not what I want. I want that big gold ball in my house.
Right.
So it just, you know, even though I lost, got there, I was upset, tore my house up for a while, came home, busted out some windows, and, you know, broke a few chairs. Mm. But then I said to myself, okay, what's the lesson here? Aha, don't celebrate too early.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think has always made you so popular with fans is that you actually seem to be having fun on the court, behaving the way that people imagine they would if they got the chance to be in your shoes. And, you know, I think that we hear the stories, the fun stuff about pranking teammates or having fun with the media or whatever. Why do you think you let yourself enjoy that more than a lot of other people do?
It's what I was taught. My father took me to a game one time, and the game was terrible. So his message was, and his message was always the correct message, glad to listen. People pay a lot of money to watch you guys play. Daddies, businessmen, fans, right? So imagine a father taking his kid to a ball game, spending whatever, and now it's a lot.
It's crazy, yeah.
Put on a show. Win or lose, put on a show. Jump into the stands. Have arguments with the fans. Just put on a show, right? Because that's what it's all about. I mean, it's basketball is there, but, you know, when you get a couple seconds to run over, eat somebody popcorn, and, you know, take a pit, like, put on a show. So that was my whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I was on the other side. When my dad had to borrow $20, I'm way at the top, and it was a shitty game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, so my dad was like, man, if you ever make it, put on a show.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to, you know, put on a show for the people.
That's great. In 96, you were a free agent. Obviously, you ultimately made the decision to leave the Magic for the Lakers. I want to quote a CBS Sports article from 20 years later. Quote, it was perhaps the most significant free agent signing ever in any sport. Never before and at no time since has a single free agent's decision so definitely destroyed one potential dynasty while at once birthing another. and even that fails to capture the full impact of this move. The day Shaq went to L.A., the entire NBA landscape shifted in a way that is still being felt today, close quote. So why on July 18th, 96, did you decide to do that? It was a major moment in your life.
Two reasons. A lot of other movies I used to watch were mafia movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm the godfather of Orlando. You got another guy who's a godfather. They wanted to pay him more. Now, if you pay him more than me, I lose all power, right?
Right.
That ain't gonna happen. Right? So right. Then I get out to L.A. So now my thing in L.A., shit, Magic's gone. All this shit could be mine now, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm thinking movies. I'm thinking all of that.
Right.
It could be mine.
Was Kazam before or after L.A.?
No, I think it was before.
Yeah.
But forget all that. Yeah. I'm like, man, this could be mine.
Right.
And then they paid me the 120, highest paid. I said, cool, come out here.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about all that. And then Jerry West made it even sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we went in the forum, and he said, look, I know you're doing a lot of stuff. And they had a little light show, boom, boom, boom. He said, but at the end, when you're done playing and you retire, you could either be a bum or you could be up there. I was like, oh, okay.
Sounds good.
Bum, huh? Yeah. All right. Okay, Mr. West.
You're right.
So, yeah, another challenge that I had to face. And from listening to him and doing it my way, I'm up there.
Yeah.
When you go up there and you look.
And the statue and everything, yeah.
You see my little jersey.
I believe that the year you joined the Lakers was the same year that Phil Jackson did, and also the same year that they drafted Kobe, something that was only possible.
No, they didn't draft Kobe. Kobe was here because they had to trade Vlade.
Yeah. And the reason they did that, though,
was to get more money.
Right, so that they could come to you.
No, because I told Orlando 150. So when Jerry asked, I said 150.
Yeah.
So they only had 98 at the time.
Right.
And then Orlando knew they only had 98, so Orlando offered me 100. And that man over there, he said, just hold up for 2 days. I was getting ready to sign. I was like, 100 million? Sure, I'm not, you know, 100 for five, that's 20, I'm good. He was like, no, hold up. So we was in Atlanta doing Olympics. So I was partying,
right.
And then me and him was at the club, and we got a call from Mr. West. He said, I got some good news and some bad news. And he's like, well, what's up? He said, come to my suite. So we get up there. He said, I couldn't get the 150, but I got the 120. And I got you a young, exciting player. In a couple of years, you and him are going to dominate the league like ever before. But I wasn't trying to hear that. I was like, let me see that piece of paper.
Right.
120. All right, sign.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. Call my lawyer. Hey, that's good to sign? Sign. Boom, 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 boom. Make sure it wasn't one of those 120s where you got to do this. And
right.
It's a straight 120. Up. I said, all right, I'll take it.
But it is kind of amazing, though. What I guess the point I was driving at is that Kobe's in L.A. so that
because
you could be
me.
In L.A.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think that's always noted, but...
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. So from in 2000, 2001, and 2002, a few years into being there, you guys three-peat, which is just I think people need a little bit of time to realize how unusual and special that is. But that happened because of you and Kobe and bringing out the best in each other,
no,
right?
No, but before that, we had a lot of good coaches, but I needed somebody that was going to take us over the edge. It's all about resume and respect, mm-hmm. especially with me. Mm-hmm. If you ain't never been there before, I'm not listening to you.
Right.
And the reason why I'm not listening to you because when we lose, it's going to be my fault.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you don't know what you're talking about, I can't go with you. Right?
Right.
I went upstairs, told Jerry, I said, hey, man, give me Phil Jackson. And the reason why I want that because during the timeouts, when he's calling the play, guys know he know what he's talking
right.
about. We just seen the man win three. Mike take a year, I'll come back and win three again. So the man knows what the hell he's talking
right.
about. Bring me somebody like that. So during tough times, because I always say when the general panics, the troop will panic. I had a lot of coaches that don't know what they're doing with 2 seconds left.
Right.
So I said, bring me Phil. So when the guys look in his eye and they see his confidence, you already know me and Kobe are super confident.
Right.
I need somebody that's going to keep them in line. And that's what happened. So he came and we won three in a row, and it was a wonderful thing.
So let me ask you, though, because we, a year ago when Dear Basketball was in the mix, we had Kobe on this podcast, and I asked him the same question. You and he obviously brought out the best in each other in a lot of ways, but also, obviously, some degree of clashing. What
no,
do you think?
No, it was only media clashing, and you can't always believe what you read in the media. Clashing to me is when you're inside the square and you clash. That never happened. If it would have happened, we wouldn't have won 3 out of 4. And when you're a leader, you worry about the relationship or you worry about the task. I'm not worrying about no relationship. The task is to win championships, to win multiple championships. So as a leader, I have to look at each person like my man's over there is tough. I could say something to him. You're probably a little sensitive, so I got to hold it back. She's tough. I could talk to her. The sound guy, I don't know him. So, I just, right. like, you have to, can't treat everybody the same. So, right. Colby, I know if I piss him off, he's going to do the same thing I'm doing. But I can't talk to Rick like that. I can't talk to Big Shot Bob like that. But, you know, he has his way. I have my way. He wants to be the man. I want to be the man. It actually worked out perfectly.
So it was always a motivational strategy kind of?
For me, yes. Yeah. Because I don't get personal. That's what people don't understand. And then, you know, he had his media people. I had mine. And it was fun. I also knew coming to L.A., marketing is very important. And marketing is very expensive.
Branding, yeah.
But I know how to get free marketing. You're laughing.
It's true.
I know how to keep my name in everybody's mouth, whether it's positive or negative. Shaq and Kobe fight. But when we got in that square, was never any fighting. You don't believe me? When I won my first championship, who's the first guy jumped in my arm? The guy that people thought we hated. It's not about, if you respect the guy you're working with, that's all you need. I don't have to like him. I don't have to do what you eat, where you eat, do what you do, but I respect him, and he respected me. That's all I care about. You don't have to like me or like my ways.
I think he mentioned, and I wonder if you recall it the same way, that I think the first time or one of the first times there was a practice that you were both at, was there something where maybe you were trying to motivate him by talking a little smack about whatever, just about getting him riled up, and he acted as if he could fight back, which size-wise wasn't going to work well for him.
Yeah,
but
I always did that with everybody.
It
was, you know, part of my strategy to see who I'm going to war with.
Yeah.
Are you tough or are you a punk? Right. Yeah, I gotta test you out at the crib first before I take you out in them streets.
So with everybody that you played with, where did he stack up as far as that?
It's not about comparing people because they're going to hear this podcast and I don't want them to think I'm comparing them. All the great guys that I play with have been great.
Yeah.
They have all made a name for themselves. Penny, I didn't get enough time to play. I didn't get a chance to play enough with him, and he was injured a lot. But him and Grant Hill are one of those guys that if they weren't hurt, they're probably T-Mac.
Yeah.
You know, they'll probably still be talked about now. Kobe, we had our trial and tribulation. We did it together. D-Wade, I taught D-Wade to be a mini Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
I was older when I played with Nash and LeBron, so I really couldn't get the powerful effect of what that duo could have been. But all the guys I played with have been great. But I'm not going to compare.
No, that's fair.
Know.
What was your favorite Lakers memory? I think it did involve with Kobe, right?
My favorite Lakers memory is sitting on that stage next to the Laker greats.
Yeah.
Same guys I used to watch when I was on punishment.
You're talking about when you were your jersey was retired?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And same guys that my father told me when I was a terrible player, hey, man, if you listen to me, I can make you that good.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, shit, that ain't going to happen.
But in terms of when you were playing still?
Oh, probably the birthday game, 61. Because that game, Kareem was with the Clippers, and every time I scored, because I was out there showing off for him.
Yeah.
So every time I scored, he wouldn't look at me. So I was like, oh, you're not going to look at me? All right.
And was Game 7, 2000 West Finals?
That was cool.
There was a nice alley-oop there?
Yeah, that's actually up there.
Why did you end up with the Miami Heat?
Because I got traded.
Why did you get traded?
Mafia rules.
What do you mean?
They wanted to go with the younger Don, and the older Don got taken out.
Was that fair?
It's business. It ain't about being fair. It's business.
Why were you agreeable to going to Miami?
Because it's business. Again, my childhood prepared me for everything that I'm going through now. I'm used to moving every 4 years.
But there was also some allure of playing with Wade, right?
Yeah. I told him, if you're going to trade me, because I probably got one or two more in me, you're going to have to trade me to a contender. And I went and I made Miami a contender. We actually could have won that first year, but I was hurt.
How much did it mean to you to get that other title where, you know, I know that you're saying a lot of this was going on in the media, but people were saying, can Kobe win without Shaq? Can Shaq win without Kobe?
It meant a lot because, you know, when you're competing, everything goes. Smack talking goes. What you guys write goes. So, yeah, definitely I wanted to win.
You probably should have won a couple of those MVPs, right?
And I was pissed when he got that one more than I did.
I
was super pissed.
But, I mean, with those Nash MVPs, probably should have been yours, too.
I know that.
Moving towards the present, just those last few years, 08-09 with the Suns, 09-10 with the Cavs with LeBron, and then 10-11 with the Celtics. What's it like when your body is not cooperating as much as it once did and you're getting a little older in the game? How do you handle it?
It wasn't about me. I felt I let the people down. Because people used to seeing Shaq 30, 40, throw bowls, start fights. I didn't feel good myself averaging 11, 12 points. That's why when I got hurt in Boston, I went in the next day and told him, keep the million that you owe me. Wow. He's like, no, we want to give it to him. He's like, nope, I didn't earn it. Keep it.
Wow.
I didn't feel good averaging 6 points, but it happens. But again, the way I was raised and trained, I had a lot to fall back on. I'm one of those guys that, hey, I used to get told and disciplined so much.
Yeah.
Now that I'm retired, but guess what? Still got the same house.
Yeah.
Still doing whatever you want to do. And, oh, my God, Charles Barkley and them want you to come join them and have more fun. Hey, let's right. do that, too. So,
last playing era question. That one season with LeBron, you arrived and you were quoted as saying, quote, my motto is very simple, win a ring for the king.
And we would have won if dumbass Big Baby ain't break my hand.
Yeah.
Because we were first. And I was just getting ready to get into it. And then I had to sit out 6 weeks. And then they inserted me in the lineup and I wasn't in basketball shape. I was in gym shape, mm-hmm. and just didn't work out.
But that year, what do you think LeBron learned from you? What did you learn from LeBron?
He didn't have to learn anything from me. He was already in control. It was the first time I didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, and I was actually pleased.
Yeah.
And he did it the right way.
Yeah.
He actually did the same way I did it.
He was a good teammate.
Yeah, jumped on guys when he needed to, motivated guys, invited guys to his house to be doing it the right way.
Nice. When did you first begin thinking about life after basketball, and then when did you know it was time to retire?
Probably 5 years before I retired.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I really started getting into, you know, doing other things.
Have you ever second-guessed the decision to retire when you did?
Nope.
So there was never going to be any chance of a comeback or something?
No, when I got hurt, I was glad I got hurt.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How come?
Because I'm done.
But you could have been done without getting hurt if you wanted to be.
No.
You needed a real reason.
And then the crazy thing, I knew I was going to go out by injury. Every day in high school and college, what's going to happen when you blow your knee out and can't play no more?
Because you'd had Osgood Schlatter as a kid, right? That's not fun.
That's not fun, but I knew I was going to go out with a career-ending injury. I knew it because I used to hear it all the time.
If, for whatever reason, you sign with an NBA team today, if that was possible, right, and you had to step on the court tonight, how would that go? Are you physically hurting still, or how would that go?
It wouldn't happen because I'd be robbing the people. Of course, if I said I'm coming back, it'll be a whole media show and boom, boom, boom.
Right.
And people will pay extra money. And it'll be the worst investment they ever had to watch a guy come back and play. Because if I come back, I want to give them a Shaq show. I don't want to give them a bullshit show.
Right.
So I wouldn't do that to the people.
How'd you adjust to retirement? You know, were you happy or bored, or how did you feel?
The first couple weeks, I was bored.
Yeah.
But then once I got the call from TNT, everything picked up.
And you know, some athletes, when they're done playing, it seems like they want to get away from the game. Others, I see like now with baseball, A-Rod's enjoying being a commentator, different other folks. Did you expect to like being around the game but not being able to play the game as much as you have?
Of course.
You did?
Also, what I learned from karate and mafia movies, when your time is up, your time is up. Nobody has the spot forever.
Right.
So my 19 years, I controlled it. I controlled both families. Like every time I went to, I controlled it.
Right.
Every guy that was a grandmaster karate guy before me, I killed them off. Right?
Right.
I became the guy. Nobody has killed me off.
Right.
I just disappeared in the woods with my white beard and my robe.
But it doesn't sting to be around the game still and see other people doing what you love doing?
No, not at all.
What is the Shaq Summit?
Shaq Summit is where I get all my businesses together. So we can align and have the same message. I let them all know that I'm in the fun business and I have a lot of different deals, but it's not good business to be all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a summit. You let him know what you're doing. He lets you know what you're doing. And then maybe y'all could do something together. And then everybody, it's one message, fun. So if you're going to design a commercial for me, it's fun. Can't be doing a fun commercial here, serious commercial over there, a sad commercial. No, this is how we doing it. This is how we doing it. And we should all work together. Something I decided in 1992 as a youngster.
And you're adamant you are not going to endorse a product that you don't like or use, right?
I will never take people's money.
Yeah.
It's not a good business.
So you've acted in a few films over the years. Of course, you know, we mentioned a couple of them, including Kazam, which you said you did at the time because why not, right? You get a chance to be in a movie. They offer you $7 million or something.
Newark, New Jersey, juvenile delinquent. Guy comes and says, we're going to pay you to do a movie. You think I'm going to say no? No, never.
And it was intended in your mind
for kids.
For children, yeah.
So all those adults that have something to say, don't matter what you say.
Right.
I've heard it before.
Right. Since retiring from basketball, it seems like it's not like there was a desire to continue acting, but there seems to have been interest in remaining involved with the movies. Why does producing appeal to you? And you've now done it with several documentaries. What's the criteria for when you decide to get involved with something?
My new role in life, being an alien, is to enlighten the people, make them laugh, help them out. Like every investment I make is to better the world. For example, Ring, affordable home security. We all need that. Amazon just bought us $4 billion. So that's my new whole thought process, right? So if I could produce something that, you know, gives people certain information or produce something that's funny or be a part of something that's helpful to society,
right,
that's what I'm all about. So that's why producing appeals to me.
It's not only documentaries. There was a narrative film with sort of a faith-based angle. There was another documentary about a year ago. And now we have Killer Bees, the story of the Bridgehampton High School basketball team and its coach as they defend their state title while having to battle racism, gentrification, and income inequality in the Hamptons. How did this first cross your radar?
One of my partners, Glenn Furman, he brought it to my attention, and I saw it, and I was like, hey, I want to be a part of this. You know, I definitely want to be a part of this because I've been wasting money in the Hamptons looking for Leonardo DiCaprio and Jay-Z, looking for all them people.
Right.
And I never knew it was this sad. I never knew any of that. So when I saw it, and then, of course, the basketball part appealed to me. And, you know, I was like, you know what, this sort of, I went to a small school and everybody doubted us and we had certain issues. I had a couple guys that went to jail and got shot, like all the same issues. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. But I don't think people know that about the Hamptons. Because when I got first introduced to Hampton, hey, Leonardo DiCaprio throwing a party, let's go. So me and a couple of my boys, we went up there, we couldn't find him.
Right.
But we, you know, you see all the rich people partying, eating caviar
boats,
and all that, and
yeah,
on their boats. And so I've been going up there for 30 years, seeing that crap. I never knew they had a real side.
Mm-hmm. When you saw the film, was it still at a point where you could provide some notes or suggestions about even, you know, ways to tinker with it? I think like you and Larry Gagosian from the art world, you guys have signed on as producers, but did you feel that you could bring a perspective that maybe they didn't already have?
First thing I learned as a leader is never micromanage.
Mm-hmm.
Guys did the film, that's how they wanted to present it. I'm with them, I'm down with them, but you never micromanage people. Because if I wanted the film to be a certain way, then I should have got my ass out there and directed it. I didn't. I'm a producer. I'm a partner. So we like the way it's cut.
Yeah.
We like the way it's set up. They're actually from that area, so they know a lot more about that area than I do.
And so for you, the thing is, by being part of it, you can call more attention to it, bring it to a wider audience?
Yeah, I can bring it to a wider audience. I could, you know, tweet about it and talk about it, and you know, hopefully we can gain some traction.
You did do something really nice, I think, which was to go and reach out to the Bridgehampton players and coaches and parents. Can you talk about what that was like? I imagine them meeting you has got to be a big thing.
I had a Shaq day this summer. We ran out the gym. We shot. We talked. I took pictures with damn near the whole town. And we had fun. And I was just there in the Hamptons again, hanging out, and then took a ride to that side and just, you know, let them know that people care about them. And let them know that, hey, I understand what you're going through. I'm from a similar type area.
Right. You know what people are going to say. They're going to say, Kobe wins an Oscar, Shaq is coming for one of his own.
Right.
What do you say to that?
I say, as an alien, I have never competed with man.
Right.
Or woman. My job is to make them smile and make them happy. If we win, of course, it's going to be a lot of chatter. If we lose, it's going to be a lot of chatter. But I didn't get involved with the film for that.
No, I know. I'm teasing.
You know, when you have as much jewelry and hardware as I have, another one's not going.
Right.
It's not going to do damage. I mean, but it'd be nice to have for my own thing. It'd be, and then the story that I started in 1996 is still being talked about today. So which should tell you that I'm a genius. I know what I'm doing. Think about it. Every time he does something like that, so you compare me and him. Guess what?
My name is still out there.
No, it's fine. Listen, it don't hurt my feelings.
Right.
It's what I wanted.
No,
but you don't know. It's what I wanted. It doesn't hurt my feelings. This is like I knew what I was doing when I was causing them. And then after I left, I talked a lot of trash. We're still the most highest rated watch game in NBA history. All because I hate them. I hate the Bucks fan. Magic used to live next to, forget him. Like I knew exactly what I was doing.
Right.
But if you know and understand me, that's not how I am in real life.
The last thing I want to ask you, we always close with what we call a rapid fire. Just the first thing that comes to your
mind. Let's do it.
Where do you fall on the matter of Kaepernick?
I don't.
Would you kneel if you were playing?
No. And the reason is because my father was a military man. But again, like, first thing they told me is to be understanding. I understand both sides, right? But my daddy was a military man. You mess around with that flag if you want to. He's passed away now, but guess what? He made me who I am today, so I'm not going to disrespect it. However, I understand that it ain't about the flag. Mm-hmm. I also understand that side. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of times you just, you know, because that's not what I do. My thing is reach kids, talk to kids, help out homeless people, you know, help out old people. That's what I do. I don't make noise and, you know, tweet this, right. Tweet that. That's not what I do. But I understand both sides. But to answer your question, would I kneel? No. Out of respect for my father, no. But again, out of respect for Kaepernick and the other side, it ain't about the flag. It's right. Never about the flag. It's about bringing awareness to a lot of stuff that has been going on damn near my whole life. Right. So I understand both sides.
Who are the five greatest centers in NBA history?
Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain, Hakeem Olajuwon, and probably David Robinson.
No Shaq?
No.
Come on.
I never rate myself.
You missed more than 20% of the games that you could have played in during your career because of injuries.
So that means I probably would have been number three on the scoring list.
That's what I want to
ask. And I missed 5,000 free throws. That's the only thing that pisses me off about my career.
Right. Who was the best player you ever played with or against?
With? Probably Kobe. Against? Hakeem Olajuwon.
Who's the greatest player in NBA history?
I'm going to have to go with Dr. J or Jordan.
If you had a gun to your head, which one?
Got to go with Dr. J. That's my guy.
Really?
Yep. Because Dr. J created all this. He was the first cool brother to do it. And then everybody just, you know, followed that. Yeah. And made it cooler.
The last thing I want to ask you is that, to set it up, you went back and completed your college degree. You then got a master's from the University of Phoenix and then from Barry University, a doctorate. I don't know if people know that. And I
did that for my children.
That's what I want to ask. Yeah.
Because, look, Shaq is cool and all that, but I want them to be able to say, hey, my daddy was the man. So now when I go to these parent-teacher meetings, they're not allowed to call me Shaq. Hello, Dr. Neil. Yeah, what's happening? Oh, he's not doing the homework? I'll take care of it. So they know. And then when I talk to them about education, they know that, hey, man, I know what I'm talking about. Like when it came to being physical and being mean, my father was an expert at that. So when he taught me how to do it, I'm like, you know what? You're not one of those soft dads because I've seen you knock a few people out.
Right.
You know, so.
And he passed away in what year?
Yes, he passed, I don't know, a couple of years ago.
A few years ago. He would be very... Yeah. Proud of that, right?
Yeah. Oh, he'll definitely be proud of that. So I want them to know and understand that education is very important.
Right. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.